From CAFE and the Vox Media Podcast Network, this is Stay Tuned in Brief. I'm Preet Bharara. You may think you spent a lot of money during the holidays, but it probably wasn't nearly as much as Rudy Giuliani was ordered to pay two Georgia election workers that he defamed. In December, a federal jury in D.C. decided that Trump's former attorney and my predecessor as U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York owed $148 million to Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss, a mother and daughter who suffered after Giuliani accused them of trying to steal the 2020 election. Giuliani's actions in the days since the decision have led the election workers to file yet another lawsuit against him, seeking a court order to stop Giuliani from continuing to defame them. So there's a lot to discuss here. I'm joined by my friend Michael Gottlieb, who has been representing the two plaintiffs in their legal pursuits against Giuliani. Michael is a partner at the law firm Wilkie Farr & Gallagher. He formerly served as associate counsel to President Barack Obama. He clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens on the Supreme Court. And most importantly, of course, he was my colleague on the Senate Judiciary Committee during the hearings of John Roberts and Sam Alito. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Preet, and honored you'd call me a colleague rather than your water boy.
I didn't want to say intern, but we've all aged and grown and done many things since then, 17 years ago.
I appreciate it.
So before we get to the case, could you just describe to folks who Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss are and were?
Sure. So, you know, Ruby Freeman is Shay Moss's mother. They are lifelong residents of Atlanta, Georgia. Shay has worked or had worked for Fulton County in its elections department for her entire career since leaving college. It was the only job she ever had. And during the 2020 election, her mom, Ruby Freeman, raised her hand to come in as a temporary worker to help. This was in the middle of COVID. And so there was an unprecedented flood of absentee ballots to process and count. And her mom raised her hand, and the two of them worked together at State Farm Arena in Atlanta, counting ballots in the 2020 election. And that is how they got mixed up in all of this mess.
So to summarize, they are patriotic public servants who worked in support of democracy. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yes.
So you represented them in connection with the lawsuit, the defamation suit against Rudy Giuliani. Could you provide maybe the most damaging examples of what you folks claimed and then proved were defamatory with respect to this mother and daughter?
Sure. There's so much of it that it's kind of hard to boil it down.
Yeah, that's why I was asking you to pick the word. I mean, it's all terrible, but let me ask it this way. What were some of the things that Giuliani said that were most damaging to your clients?
Sure. So the core of the sort of allegations that he made against our clients and then sort of spread all around the internet were that they were engaged in a plot to rig the election in Georgia for Joe Biden. And that the way they did that was on election night, they allegedly made up an excuse that there had been a water main break. They kicked everybody out of the counting facility at State Farm Arena. They locked the doors. They cased the joint. They then, when everybody was gone, all the election observers were gone, they then pulled out suitcases of ballots from underneath the table. They scanned them 5, 6, 7 times, manufacturing, you know, what ranged in his allegations from 30,000 to 100,000 votes for Joe Biden. Then he also alleged that they had a history of voter fraud participation, and that earlier in the day they had been seen on video passing around USBs to rig the Dominion voting machines that Giuliani claimed were being used in the facility. That was the sum of the allegations, and every single piece of it was false.
And was he doing this at a small venue of like 3 or 4 drunk friends or some different platform? Because that's what's important here, it turns out, right?
Yeah. So this was a story that began on December 3rd at a hearing before the Georgia legislature, where the Giuliani legal team presented these claims based on sort of misleadingly cut clips of surveillance video from the night of election night at State Farm Arena. And then they sort of used the social media tools available to them, which were extraordinary, really. I mean, the reach that President Trump's accounts had, that other members of the Giuliani legal team, and then sort of the echo chamber that they had access to, just took this information and, you know, over the course of a few weeks in December of 2020, really spread it around the world to the tune of, you know, what our expert calculated as hundreds of millions of impressions of these statements generated across social media platforms, traditional media platforms, print. So they basically took two, you know, patriotic civil servants with no criminal record, no history of anything, and made them sort of the face of election fraud in a matter of a few weeks.
And if you can describe, how did you counteract the mountains and mountains of evidence that Giuliani had in support of his allegations of election fraud? What's nice about having a podcast, Mike, is you can ask totally improper questions.
No, I love it. No, I wouldn't object to that one. You know, the thing about your question, and this is one of the frustrating things about handling cases in this space and handling sort of cases involving political disinformation, is that the promise of the conspiracy theorist is always that proof is just around the corner.
Right.
It's coming, right? Winter is coming.
It's just like Infrastructure Week.
Yes, it's similar.
It's always a week away.
Yeah. And the thing about discovery, as you know, is that if you really believe what you're saying, then discovery is great because you get subpoena power.
Right.
So think about what, you know, if Rudy Giuliani really believed all of the things he was saying, think about what he could have accomplished for free in discovery. It wouldn't have even cost him anything. He could have issued third-party subpoenas to Georgia state investigators, to third-party platforms, to social media platforms, to assemble all this evidence using subpoena power, and then used that to prove his defense of substantial truth, which is a defense in a defamation case. And of course, he did none of those things. Not one effort. He didn't even show, you know, we subpoenaed in the case the Georgia state investigators who looked into these claims and wrote reports and concluded an investigation that fully exonerated Ruby and Shea and also everybody else who was involved at State Farm Arena and found them to have been engaged in normal ballot processing and counting. You know, we subpoenaed them and deposed them, and Giuliani didn't even show up to the deposition to ask them questions. So one of the frustrating things about seeing how he then reacts to this after the verdict and claiming that he didn't have a opportunity to present evidence or is saying it was a sham trial or things like that is, you know, he had vast powers granted to him if he wanted to actually prove this stuff to be true, and he didn't even try. He didn't even show up.
Well, one of the reasons why he had a ruling issued against him even before the trial that was mostly for the purpose of determining damages was his failure to be responsive in discovery. Am I right?
Yeah, it's the dog ate my homework defense.
Right. Can I ask you, not as a legal question, but what the hell was going on there? what's your theory about why he would basically mosey into a default judgment? It's not quite a default judgment, but mosey into a judgment against him that left to the jury just a question of how much money he should be able to be forced to pay.
It was a default judgment. It was just an unusual default judgment.
Right.
So it was usually when we're talking about default judgments, we're talking about, you know, Al Qaeda or Iran gets sued. They don't show up for anything.
Yeah.
And you get a default judgment and then you proceed.
He showed
like
up
that.
For some stuff, but not for other stuff.
Yeah. He showed up to litigate the motion to dismiss and then to do a few things and then decided that he wasn't interested in the case anymore and stopped participating.
What universe does that make any rational? I mean, I guess one question I have for you is, if it doesn't prejudice your client, if to answer, is Rudy Giuliani a rational actor in any sense?
In any sense, yes. Okay. I think.
In what sense is Rudy Giuliani a rational actor?
Well, I mean, I deposed him. Mm-hmm. He showed up for the deposition.
How'd that go?
He answered questions rationally during the deposition. So, I mean, I think there are certain things that he does and did that are rational. He clearly has a press strategy and an audience that he speaks to. And I think that there is a reason for what he does with that audience. It is, I think, designed to provide a source of income and sustain an image that he believes he's created for himself. So I think there's reason behind all that. I don't think there was a rational strategy to showing up and then defaulting and then showing up again to contest damages at trial.
Not just damages at trial. During the trial, I wanted to ask you this since I found out you were available to come on the show. During the trial, when he goes out to a podium, he says, all that stuff I said, it's totally true, even though it had already been determined by the judge to not be true. Just as a person and as a lawyer, what did you mutter or how did you react when you saw the defendant doing that?
Well, I mean, I had sort of two reactions to it. I think the first of which you understand as a former prosecutor. I mean, if you saw the defendant in your case go out and do that, that's a gift, right?
Yeah. that's true.
That's a gift. And we knew that was going to get in front of the jury and that was not going to end well for him. But on behalf of my clients, you know, it's frustrating because there's been a default judgment in the case. He stipulated to liability before the entry of the default judgment. So he agreed he wasn't going to contest that the statements were false, that they were made with actual malice, that it caused harm to our clients, that he stipulated to those things. So then seeing him out in public undermining that is frustrating. Yeah. Because one of the objectives of a defamation case is to restore your client's reputation.
Yeah, and so, stop the harm.
Yeah. We want to stop the harm. And, you know, you mentioned before that we've filed this follow-on lawsuit. I mean, one of the reasons we had to file that is to prevent him from, you know, continuing to go out and saying these same things, because it does cause harm. And you could see in the evidence in the case, the spikes in the threats and the sort of derogatory online comments about our clients that would happen after major events. And so every time you have somebody like Rudy Giuliani or Trump or whoever going out and saying things like this about our clients, it does cause them additional harm. So it's a serious thing that we have to take action against. But it just, as far as, you know, from a litigation perspective, as soon as he said that, I thought he was done.
Yeah. Could you describe for listeners what the legal strategy was in the damages trial and what stories you told and how you wanted to convince the jury that they should render such a sizable damages verdict?
Yeah. So it was challenging in the sense that we had a default judgment, so liability was established, but to demonstrate, to prove the elements of reputational harm and also punitive damages, we had to get into the, you know, why the statements about our clients were so harmful, how far they traveled, you know, the fact that Giuliani was repeating them. So a lot of the sort of liability issues that you would think about in a case like this had to come in, but in really abbreviated form. So we only had about 3 days of trial to fit a fairly long story into. But the, you know, the idea was to show the jury in very real concrete terms the harm that our clients suffered, and to demonstrate that Giuliani had been a proximate cause of that harm in terms of the timing of what he said and how threats to them followed, but to really let the jury feel and experience those threats. So we had voicemail messages that Ruby and Shay received. We had text messages that they had received. We had physical mail that had been sent to Ruby Freeman's house that had these just grotesque pictures and drawings in them. So we had, physical evidence to actually let the jury sort of see what it looked like. And then we had our clients, you know, take the stand and testify under oath to tell from their perspective how they had experienced, you know, going from, completely private, unknown civil servants to these infamous face of election fraud basically overnight. And they heard, the jury heard stories of how people came to perform a citizen's arrest at Shea Moss's grandmother's house. And they heard story about how Shea Moss, and this is the one that I think got to me the most, but when Shea testified, she told the story about how when all this happened, it was during COVID and her son was 14 years old and was at home doing remote school. And he used his mom's phone as a, like a Wi-Fi hotspot type of way of logging into remote school. And he kept getting kicked off of class because people were calling Shay's phone because she got doxxed. And they were calling, making these vile, racist, just awful threats. So you just imagine this 14-year-old getting booted from his classes during COVID because these people are harassing his mom based on just terrible lies. So the strategy was to make that feel and seem real, which it was, I think. And then to convince the jury that, the worth of someone's reputation is not a product of their income bracket, that you measure harm to reputation based on the damage that's been done, not based on, lost business deals or how much
money. But also a theory that you pursued, which was to explain to the jury how much it would cost to restore the reputation. Is that a common strategy?
That is a strategy that I would say we've been working on for a few years. This is not the first case that we worked on that theory with this particular expert, Dr. Ashley Humphreys. There's one case prior to this that didn't wind up going to trial, where we had developed that theory and worked with Dr. Humphreys on presenting it. And then she wound up being the testifying expert in the E. Jean Carroll case,
right,
where she used a similar theory of cost to repair. But it's a simple theory. It's essentially, imagine that an arsonist comes in and burns down your house. You want to figure out how much damage did the fire do. And one of the ways you figure that out is you ask, how much would it cost to rebuild it?
Replace the house, right.
That might be a function of the value of the house, but depending on if you imagine, and we use this example with the jury, if you imagine that not just the house burned down, but they used hazardous chemicals that, totally corroded the foundation of the home and made it unlivable, such that it was impossible or difficult to repair it in that location, the cost might be, far in excess of whatever the value of the house might have been before the fire. So we tried to come up with a straightforward way of explaining the concept of how somebody who, wasn't a millionaire could still suffer, tens of millions of dollars in reputational damage. And and I think it stuck.
Cassio, I know this is another question that I'm not asking you in your capacity as a lawyer, but as a person, did the facts of this case make you angry? Like what emotions did you experience, if any, in litigating this case on behalf of Ruby and Shea?
Wow. Anger.
This isn't cable news, buddy.
I think whatever the full 12 stages are, anger, rage.
As you describe the facts, as I've read them, and my first encounter with your clients through the January 6th committee proceedings, I got angry from my seat.
Yeah. So there are pieces of it that are heartbreaking and depressing, but heartbreaking for Ruby and Shea and their family, and sort of fill you with rage on behalf of them, but also on behalf of all the other people who worked in Fulton County Elections and at State Farm, who were all sort of branded as, criminals and crooks. These people were working, 16, 18-hour days in the middle of the pandemic to help process votes. So on their behalf, just anger and rage and all of those emotions. And then just, some amount of frustration and depression over the fact that so many people come to believe things like these USB allegations that, when you actually break them down pre, you know, as a litigator or prosecutor, and you actually think about them in terms of proof, and you realize how absurd they are, like how many just logical questions people were not asking, like, you know, this alleged USB video that they said where our clients were passing USBs in order to rig the vote counts, that, you know, the big bump that happened for Biden votes. It turns out that video that is the source of that alleged passing off of a USB, which was actually a Ginger Mint, was the day after the election. So it was after, like, we didn't even get into any of this stuff in the trial, but like, so there's just frustration with how easily people can come to believe some of this. But then I would tell you emotionally, you know, it was uplifting and hopeful at the end of the trial. Even before the verdict, it was uplifting seeing the power that the justice system, seeing the inversion of power of Ruby and Shay testifying under oath on the stand, telling their truth and establishing a clear, unimpeachable historical record about what happened. And that was uplifting.
A story of vindication.
Absolutely.
So the question I've gotten most frequently with respect to your clients, in particular since the judgment of $148 million by the jury, is how do they get it? Because Giuliani doesn't have $148 million. How does that process work, if you can say, and how much might they ultimately see?
So the answer to the question is a little different now than it was the day after the judgment, because Mr. Giuliani filed for bankruptcy. So,
but he can't discharge this debt, right?
That's right. So we believe, although this hasn't been litigated yet, but we believe this debt is not dischargeable. But what happens when somebody files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy is the other litigation that exists out that is related to the bankruptcy all gets stayed. So, for example, our additional suit that we filed seeking injunctive relief is stayed at this point. But you know, there will be a bankruptcy process. Our clients will be involved to some extent in that, and will seek to recover from whatever distribution is made. And there is a path for this. This isn't unprecedented. So, you know, in the Alex Jones case, the Sandy Hook families, you know, have this very large judgment against him, and he's filed for bankruptcy, and the families are pursuing relief against him. And there's sort of a playbook to follow for Ruby and Shay, but also some of the other creditors of Mr. Giuliani. So, I mean, it won't be an easy process, and I'm not going to, you know, no one should think that they're going to recover $148 million through it, certainly. But there is money for them to recover through that process. And then there are, you know, they have an ongoing lawsuit against the Gateway Pundit and its founder in Missouri. And there are other people who continue to defame them, and they are, our clients are willing to continue taking this fight to the people that want to bring it to them. I should mention this case is not it's not a Michael Gottlieb case or a Wilkie Farr case. This is a case that, you know, we brought in partnership with the amazing people at Protect Democracy and the project that they established called Law for Truth. And the work that they're doing is really extraordinary work that is a bipartisan or nonpartisan work designed to protect victims of disinformation, and along with our co-counsel, Vaughn DeBose of DeBose Miller. So I would commend to folks who want to learn more about this to check out the work that the good people at Law for Truth and United to Protect Democracy are doing.
Well, you keep at it, my friend. Congratulations on all this very important work, not just for your particular clients, but for lots of other folks who hopefully will not be defamed and attacked in this way, in the way that they were. So I'm very proud of your work. It's great and important work. Thanks so much, Michael Gottlieb. For more analysis of legal and political issues making the headlines, become a member of the Cafe Insider. Members get access to exclusive content, including the weekly podcast I host with former U.S. Attorney Joyce Vance. Head to cafe.com/insider to sign up for a trial. That's cafe.com/insider.
If you like what we do, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. Send me your questions about news, politics, and justice. Tweet them to me at Preet Bharara with the hashtag AskPreet. You can also now reach me on Threads, or you can call and leave me a message at 669-247-7338. That's 669-24-PREET. Or you can send an email to letters@cafe.com. Stay Tuned is presented by Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The editorial producer is Noah Ozulai. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Curlander, Jake Kaplan, Nat Wiener, and Claudia Hernandez. Our music is by Andrew Dost. I'm your host, Preet Bharara. Stay tuned.